This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. Place to Be Nation, welcome to the epicenter of Southern wrestling, JT Allen. This is Letters from Center Stage Theater.
As the biggest night in the history of this great organization.
You are gonna feel the bad!
Place to Be Nation, welcome to episode number 20 of Letters from Center Stage. I am JT here, ready to take a cruise around that nostalgia mothership that was WCW. And joining me, as always, on that voyage is my partner on the show, the chap they call Alan. Alan, how are you, sir?
I'm brimming with excitement on this show, JT. It's a big deal for us. We finally got the man, the myth, the legend. We have Parv on the show with us. How are you doing, Parv?
Well, I'm glad to be back. I guess I'm in the Ian Mooney role this time, JT.
I guess so. Maybe not quite. You're kind of like when Roddy Piper joined the primetime with Bobby and Gorilla. You know, he was kind of there for the summer, like for that stretch on set. You know, you're not in the booth. Like, you guys kept me hidden in that little booth just giving you updates, but at least you get to partake in the show.
I was going to say, at this point, I've been gone long enough. It's more like when Bruno Sammartino cropped up in like 19... When was that? He cropped
87,
up.
87, I think, or something. Yeah.
86, 87, yeah.
There you go. So it's really exciting to have you here, Parv. And this is episode 20. And we thought the symmetry was pretty fun because episode 20 was the end of the road for Letters from Kayfabe, which the three of us obviously were part of, and into your semi-retirement onto Legends contract. And we figured, since we're hitting episode 20, we're tying that run, we had to get you here for a very special episode. Now, normally, as listeners know, we do the same format as Letters from Kayfabe, where we have the two questions, then we usually do a little bit in between, where we look at this week in history, and then we close with a long question. But tonight, we wanted to mix things up. So we're not going to be dipping into the plunder bucket. No questions tonight. We are, though, going to be doing a top 10 list. And, Alan, this is an idea we had. I feel like when we first discussed doing the show, like, we thought about doing top 10s, because WCW is pretty synonymous for that top 10 segment they used to do with their contenders back in the early 90s.
Oh, yeah, of course. So I think this is something we've been discussing and throwing ideas about. So we've all got our 10 favorite WCW moments. So it doesn't have to be a match. It doesn't have to be an angle. It could just be anything. A throwaway line. It could be anything. And I think Parv's got quite a few of those. He's hinted that. I don't literally know what either you guys have got. So I think this is going to be a whole heap of fun going through this. So what we'll do is we'll take it in turns. So Parv, you go first, then JT, then myself, and rotate. And if we've got anything that... anyone else has got, we'll defer that till later on in the show, if that makes sense.
And two, I don't just have moments, or I actually have things about WCW. So I went pretty broad on the spectrum. I just basically, what did you love, or, you know, in a wink, wink way, about WCW? What's your fond memories of it? So why don't we get started with number 10, Parv? Why don't you kick us off as you're our esteemed guest and let us know where we're going to start?
Well, my number 10, and they're all pretty much in this mode, it's when Paul Orndorff is at his midlife crisis, and then out of nowhere, Gary Spivey turns up. And so, Orndorff is like, I don't know if I'm Mr. Wonderful anymore. I think this is a Fall Brawl 95 or something like that.
Yeah, it's around there, yeah.
And I had no idea who Gary Spivey was. His hair is ridiculous. And it just, I don't know, it came out, well, I remember the first time watching it, like, who the hell is this guy? I just, one of those things that I feel like could own, like, I feel like that wouldn't have happened in Vince Land. It's the sort of thing that would happen in WCW.
You know, you know what's great about it, too, and so random, obviously, is the theme song, right? The wonderful, you know, that ridiculous theme song. And he, speaking of Vince, I was watching, there was a Raw on the network a few weeks ago, and it was the Hulk Hogan birthday celebration. I think it's probably one of Hogan's kind of tail end appearances before he was exposed as a racist. But he actually comes out, they bring out Mr. Wonderful for the celebration, and they use that theme for him. It's like,
oh, yeah.
It kind of made him look so goofy. Like, this guy was like one of your top draws in the 80s against Hogan, and they come out with this cheesy ass WCW theme song.
Yeah, I've got. I did not see his mustache as well. He had an awesome mustache when he came out like that. Yes. It was like a big Billy Busick mustache. Yes. It was pretty special. But the other thing was, it really Gary Spivey's hair? I always thought it was some sort of hat.
It's got to be. It's got to be some sort of wig or something, isn't it?
Yeah,
I thought it was.
It looks like the Shockmaster's helmet. Like, it might have been that. You know.
I just don't know, man. I just don't know. Gary Spivey.
Mr. Wonderful, they let me back here to see you.
Gary Spivey of the Psychic Companions Network? What are you doing here?
I got a vision. I knew you weren't okay. There's something I have to tell you. I know you're not okay.
You did?
Yes.
How did you know that?
I got a vision. Psychics know. You gotta listen to me.
Gary, I used to be the highest rated wrestler in the whole world. I used to have so many belts that I could carry them all.
I know. I can see these things. You're not okay, but you're Mr. Wonderful, and you're not feeling so wonderful. These things are going to pass. I see great things for you. You have to be Mr. Wonderful. That's you.
I used to be Mr. Wonderful.
Listen to me. You are Mr. Wonderful. They call you Mr. Wonderful.
True.
Look in the mirror. Who do you see? Look in the mirror. Get up. Look in the mirror. Who do you see?
I see Mr. Wonderful.
You see the vision I see. See, look, you'll see the same vision I see. I see Mr. Wonderful. Who do you see?
I am Mr. Wonderful. I am Mr. Wonderful.
You are Mr. Wonderful.
Yes, I am Mr. Wonderful.
They call you Mr. Wonderful.
I am Mr. Wonderful.
And you know you're wonderful too.
So, yeah, the whole thing was Gary Spivey, was he a motivational speaker, Parv, that kind of G'd Mr. Wonderful up?
It was like a kind of Tony Robbins deal, and he's kind of, he gets him to look in the mirror so he can see Mr. Wonderful again. And then he ends up kissing the mirror, and then he comes out like he's quite motivated for the match afterwards as well. So, like, Gary Spivey's worked his his motivational magic. So.
And I think that was coming off the Pretty Wonderful run. I think Roma got fired, and they kind of had Orndorff go into that little bit of a tailspin, and then he had to be built back up. And there's
and this is something that if Chad and I ever get back on the Where the Big Boys Play train, still on hiatus, but we may be back one day. I'm looking forward to getting to Orndorff's run there. Because I think he's already started in our timeline. We're in 1993, I think.
Yeah, I think it's when he shows up is early 1993.
Yeah, he's super motivated for that whole run. Mm-hmm. It's kind of ironic. It's kind of ironic that they do this skit here, because I feel like he's almost better in that run than he was in the 80s.
In some ways, yeah. The other thing I want to point out, you know, he's saying that he was not motivated. He needed Gary Spivey. He'd just beaten Vader up backstage in flip flops. You know, this man could go still. So I don't know what he was questioning his own ability for. He was, he could have stuck him in UFC early UFCs, and he would have cleared up there as well. So this man was all business outside the ring, anyway.
Maybe it was that arm, that shrunken arm, had him really questioning his future.
There's a funny moment where he goes on about like all the belts he used to carry. I had so many belts I couldn't carry them all. I was like, hold on, why did you ever win anything? Because in the big leagues, I guess he didn't really have any, like, I don't remember any titles for him.
Was it Herb Abrams? Did he win the titles there? I guess maybe.
I think he was North American champion, Mid South or something at one point, but
he wasn't a WCW six man champion, was he? At any point in time,
he seemed like he would have been.
Everyone was, I think, at one point. There's a really funny moment too on one of the earliest Nitros. He's fighting Johnny B. Badd, and he's outside the ring looking in the mirror. And Johnny B. Badd does this thing where he, like, comes through the ropes like he's going to kick Orndorff, and he misses him, but Orndorff sells it anyway. I don't know if he thought he was supposed to bump or if Badd just whiffed. It's a really funny bit. I think it's, like, on one of the third or fourth Nitros ever. And it's just a wicked bad botch, and Orndorff just completely sells this not getting hit at all.
Oh, good old Paul Orndorff. So that's covered him and Dan Spivey, Parv's number 10. So, JT, what's your number 10?
All right, so like I mentioned, mine are really more concept and thing-based. I don't have, like, specifics, but this is one that's kind of close to it, and that is the commentary team of Tony Schiavone and Jesse Ventura. Probably my favorite, definitely my favorite WCW commentary team. We've touched on this a bit, Alan. I think Jesse's the best color commentator in wrestling history, at least in my era, and I loved him in WWF, and I thought he was just as good in WCW. And the thing is, I just didn't think him and Jim Ross really clicked. Like, I didn't think they had the best chemistry. I think Jim Ross didn't kind of play along as much. He was too serious at that point. He would get a little bit more playful, like, later on with Jerry Lawler when he kind of had to become more of a character. But at this time, he just wanted to really be a straight-laced play-by-play man. And Jesse was great in that role. He could be, like, a straight play-by-play color guy. But with Tony, there's that much more that playful banter. And they obviously had some chemistry from their time together in the WWF in 89. And it really felt more like the Gorilla-Jesse pairing where Tony was capable enough to call the match, and he was very knowledgeable about everything going on, but he could feed and set up Jesse for some good one-liners. And I thought they had a perfect mix of a little bit of humor, some, you know, being adversarial, but also kind of being friendly, and it just kind of let Jesse do his thing. And I thought Jesse was great in WCW. I was actually kind of sad when Bobby came in and they pushed Jesse aside, because I thought Jesse was far superior in WCW. I think he's a big part of those couple year stretch, but that 1 year of 93 where him and Tony pretty much do everything, I thought was great. I loved reliving that a few years back.
WCW Worldwide is on the air. Tony Schiavone in the body. Jesse Ventura, main event is Nikita Koloff and Ricky the Dragon Steamboat against Arn Anderson and Sonny Steve Austin, and they're still chanting Jesse everywhere.
Absolutely. You know what? I've been looking at you, Schiavone. You need to make a trip to the barber. It's that simple. I don't like your hairstyle. Get back in style.
You think I should have maybe the Jesse the Body on the top look, you think? Or maybe down the back there?
I don't think you're tough enough to face it, Schiavone.
Okay, fans, all the top superstars will be here. And let's go to our first event this week on WCW Worldwide Wrestling.
Oh, God, yeah. Jesse, for me, is someone that was, you know, he's iconic in some ways. He's just his voice, his look, how he was always for the heels, but he would sometimes be for the face as well. He wasn't just one-dimensional. So big fan of Jesse. And then he went on to be the mayor of somewhere in Minnesota, I think around 94.
Brooklyn Park, like, yep. Actually, I think he was before that. I think, wasn't he mayor? I thought he was mayor while he was in, like, WCW or whatever, wasn't he?
I think he gets it in 92, I want to say. Yeah. Like, or he starts his political career. Yeah. He also has that sports commentator deal at the same time, around that same thing.
But he was in X-Files as well. I think he showed up in an episode of X-Files in 94. I don't know why I know that, but I think that's what happened as well. But yeah, he's a bit of a truther, is Jesse Ventura. He does his conspiracy theory show. He did. Now he's got wild, wacky hair, hasn't he, as well? He's still got his skullet. So yeah, Jesse's still living the gimmick. But I'm always a fan of him having the diamante or the little diamond in the bit of his chin. So, do you remember that?
There was, sorry.
The diamond, do you remember, in his chin? He's got a bum chin, like Vince McMahon. Yeah. So this was early on in his career when he was a wrestler, but he used to put a little diamond in there. I thought it was cool. Anyway.
Probably the less said about Jesse Ventura's actual wrestling career, the better. But anyone who's listened to Where the Big Boys Play will have heard this talking point a million times, but I think Jesse Ventura is the best color commentator ever as well. And one of the things that Chad and I saw kind of watching the shows through 92, 93, was that Jim Ross team. Like, it doesn't work because Jim Ross was, I hate to say it, but he's a dick. Like, he doesn't.
He's a nerd and a dick. He's a pretty much it.
He wouldn't, like, Jesse was clearly trying to build up that kind of rapport with him. And he'd no sell him, or he wouldn't respond, or, you know, and Jesse's like, keep on, like, he won't take no for an answer, Jesse, so he keeps on going, and right. Jim Ross is giving him nothing. So it's a horrible, like, there's something that really awkward about that team, which only works when there's a good match. So the Jesse flips into kind of analysis mode as opposed to character stuff.
Right.
The reason the Tony Schiavone team works so well is because Tony takes everything so personally. Like if Jesse says one comment, Tony might let it fly, but then he'll dig in a bit more. like he'll accuse him of, like, I don't know, getting beaten up by his wife, or he'll just hit him where it kind of hurts, and Tony just flips out and just be like, how dare you say that about my wife? And then they kind of get into it. It kind of, like, they have a very similar chemistry to Vince and Jesse did. Like,
yeah, that's a better comparison than Gorilla. You're right. I think Vince and Jesse's a better fit.
I always thought Vince and Jesse was one of the all-time best teams, and I think the Tony-Jesse team is, like, almost there. You know, they have a really similar... I think Tony maybe... he's more subtle in the way he gets back at Jesse. Like, right. He'll call him out on his hypocrisy and stuff.
And he's not
like
as strong-voiced as Vince. You know what I mean? Like, Vince is bombastic, where Tony's kind of more... I don't say meek, but... you're right. It's similar, but it's different. And you can see that, like, already coming to play in Tony's year in the WWF. Like, those couple pay-per-views they do together are really good. Like, they're really already in sync on that show. So it seemed like it carried over nicely.
I was just going to say, Parv, since you've been away and you've been in doing a Legends contract, we've seen the emergence of a Tony Schiavone podcast and a Sean Mooney podcast. Have you had a chance to listen to either of them?
I haven't, but at some point, you know, the bug will hit me, and I will probably listen to them all in one week, I'd imagine. Are they any good? Like,
I would say the Tony Schiavone one. He doesn't remember the details that well. He's helped by his co-host. And the Sean Mooney one, it's him and Hacksaw Jim Duggan. It's okay. It's something that, you know, they're not doing deep dives into WWF things that happen, but it's nice to see their takes, and Sean Mooney's takes, obviously, is not being an in-ring guy and what went on with the production and things. So, yeah, they're pretty good. I think you'll dig the Tony one and the Sean Mooney one, to be fair.
Great. I look forward to it.
So what we should do now is go on to my number 10, and this is a straightforward one, nice and safe, a lot of my list. And this is September the 4th, 1995, Monday Nitro, the debut episode. This was great for me because it was in the Mall of America, so we had Pastamania, you know, the tie-in with Hogan, which I thought was absolutely awesome. We had escalators, or what did you call them in the US? They're not called escalators, Parv. What did they call them? Moving stairs?
Escalators. Why are you asking Parv and not me? It's escalators they're called here. Parv, can you confirm that for me, what they call it in America?
I think he's thinking of what we call a lift, you guys call an elevator.
Elevator.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. But I did teach him on the last episode, Parv, that episodes are coming out now fortnightly, not bi-monthly.
I like it.
So he's learned something there. So September the 4th Nitro, the first one. What I also loved about it, to heat up the crowd, they brought out the American Males versus Bunkhouse Buck and Dick Slater to get the crowd going. You know, and I thought that was pretty cool. So, yeah, we had Juicy and Liger on there. It's Flying Brian. That was a hot match. You had Sting and Flair, actually the flagship guys of WCW in some ways. And then Hogan against Big Bubba, which was, you know, a big draw, you know, years ago. So they tried to, you know, get that again. And then we saw Lex Luger obviously appearing. We had Mongo in his debut as well. So there was all sorts of hijinks on this episode, and this really set the tone for me for WCW. It did feel different from from Raw at the time, and I think it was a big move. I was always hoping WCW would kind of go down this route, competing more with WWF and being a bit more live, a bit more lively. So this has definitely ticked all those boxes for me, so I was a big fan of them doing this.
I'm tired of playing around with kids. I'm here to get it on with the big boys, and that means you. And I don't care whether it's next month, next year, or 5 years from now, I'm going to get my shot.
You see this, brother? This is the WCW heavyweight title, brother. I'm the champion, and that's the way it's going to stay forever and a day. I know where you've been, brother. You've been playing games. I'm going to have to give you your due, brother. I know when you started and how long you've been at it, brother. But when you come in the WCW, when you get in Hulk Hogan's face, brother, there's thousands of Hulkamaniacs, brother, that are going to stand behind me each and every bit of the way, Luger. So as far as I'm concerned, brother, as great as you may be, you don't have to prove nothing to me, brother. You don't have to wait till next week. You don't have to wait till next month. Just stick that stinky palm of yours out, brother. Shake my hand, and I'll put the WCW title on the line next Monday on Monday Nitro right in Miami.
Yeah, I mean, partly you kind of talk about it. I know, Alan, you and I kind of covered that whole Nitro, I think, on a full episode. So I think we've exhausted our thoughts. Parv, what are your thoughts on that first Nitro?
Is that the night that Luger turns up, like, at the end?
Yeah, he strolls out at the end from, like, he's gone to a, you know, he's been in a takeaway or somewhere eating some food in the food court, and he just moseys on out to the ring.
I just love how 90s the whole thing is. Like, isn't he wearing like one of those like denim shirts? Like the whole scene, you know, like the mall, the sort of clothes that people are wearing at that time. I kind of have a little soft spot for that kind of weird period. And like, it's the Nitro era hasn't really, like, it's Nitro started, but it's not like Monday Night Wars Nitro. It's kind of like kind of right. mid-90s, pre-NWO, WCW. Like, I don't know, it's kind of a, like an interesting era. I'm looking now, it wasn't a denim shirt. It was, I guess, a Seinfeld-style puffy white shirt.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
But it's talking about like... shirt, he still has that shirt. He wears it on future TV episodes as well, like 5 years later. It's been spotted.
He's not a pirate. But yeah, that you're right, Parv, because it's a weird feeling for that whole era, like where they're trying to kind of figure things out, and all of a sudden they're throwing out like quality matches every week. I mean, they don't really ramp up to it. They're just doing it. Like, by week two, they're already doing Luger Hogan as the main event on Nitro. Yeah, so that was like a big change. But yeah, it is an interesting period because they still have kind of the old vestiges lingering. They have the Dungeon of Doom nonsense going on, but then they're also starting to bring in a lot of the foreign talent like Benoit and Guerrero and all those guys. So it is definitely an interesting melting pot era for WCW.
Yeah, so I really love that one. So what's your next one then, Parv?
My number nine is Jesse Ventura's arm wrestling contests that ran in 92 and 93. Have you guys discussed these yet?
Oh, yes. We got onto that. Maybe episode two, I think, JT. We went straight for that with the world of Van Hammer and Jesse Ventura fawning over guys. It was brilliant. And the really dodgy, the first year I think they had, it was a really dodgy arm wrestling rig that they had. And the second year, they got a bit of an upgrade in the production values and got a bit of a better one, I think.
So what I really like about this is especially that second tournament where Ice Train does really well, like in the tournament, he's like the breakout star of the arm wrestling is Ice Train. Yeah. I just like the reason I picked this is because everything about WCW at that time, I'm thinking of like Tex Slazenger and Shanghai Pierce and the kind of the sets and the way everything looked and Gary Capetta and that, like, just looking at the results of the tournament, I just love everything about, like, just the Equalizer defeated Van Hammer in round one. Do you know what I mean?
It's just big, like, upset.
And
definitely
then,
a big upset.
Yeah, and Van Hammer defeated Ron Simmons in the first tournament, so...
And there's a lot of, like, it's such a weird period because there's some good stuff in there. Like, we've talked about Tony and Jesse, and I think there's hidden stuff in 93. But on the flip side, when you look at stuff like this, you can tell why they were lagging so badly. Like, we just look at the roster that they had and the guys. Like, were these guys ever going to make any money or get over? When you just look at the guys they had out there, besides the handful of big names, it's such a weird period for them.
Yeah. Sorry, go on, Pav.
I was just going to say, have you seen Van Hammer's run? In the first tournament, he beats Vinny Vegas in round one. then he beats Nikita Koloff in the tournament. No, then he beats Vader, and then he beats Ron Simmons. Like, that's three massive wins. And he, what did Van Hammer do after that? Did it project? Is it like the King of the Ring? Did it project him to the next level?
No, I don't think he's around much longer. I mean, I know he had like a little thing with Cactus Jack, and I think he's gone like pretty quickly after that. I don't think he's around too much longer.
No, at this period, though, we had these guys doing arm wrestling. In WWF, we had tug of wars between WWF and WBF body stars, yes. You know, random Coliseum home videos, which was, you know, you wouldn't have a team with the Bushwhackers in your tug of war. Those guys weren't very big. You want some big meaty guys. So, yeah, there's some of that online as well if people want to check that out. I like it when they do something different like this. Like, they get the wrestlers and they compete in some other kind of
like
physical activity.
Like the Karate Fighters tournament? You should have had that one on. Yeah.
Oh, God. Was that the one with... what was the final of that? I shouldn't know this. Was Jerry Lawler involved?
They did, like, three of them, actually. It was, like, every year around Survivor Series. It was at least two, maybe three, yeah. Lawler, did he fight, like... Did he face off with Sable in the finals one year? And he cheated? Remember, he was, like, holding the thing down or something? And I think one year Sonny won. I don't know. There were two or three of those things. So I think it was, like, 95 through 97 they did it.
So I like it when they parlay into things like that. So, JT, what's your number nine?
So mine, again, kind of a more of a concept, but this is something I really just loved about WCW, and that's War Games. To me, one of the best gimmick creations ever, and it's amazing to me that no one has ever really taken it for their own sense. And Alan, I know we mentioned it, that Vince McMahon probably, a little reluctant to give up the floor seating and structure the arena in that way, but it seems like it's such a money gimmick when you have a big feud, and there's been times when WWF could have leveraged it, like the invasion, you know, Raw versus SmackDown, all this other stuff, that they never did it, at least tried it once. And there's so many good ones when I think back to WCW. Obviously, you have the originals with Dusty and the Horsemen and all that stuff. And then you get the year 91, which is one of the best ever, with Pillman nearly getting decapitated by Sid. 92, just the culmination of the awesome Dangerous Alliance storyline, one of the best matches in WCW history, or wrestling history in the 90s for North America. As well as then 94, which is one of my favorites, where it was the Stud Stable taking on Dusty, Dustin, and the Nasty Boys. To me, the last great old-school style WCW match before the Hogan stuff like really just took over. That's kind of like you have Hogan kind of and his friends kind of starting to fill in, but you have this one last feud that's a standing tall with the Stud Stable versus the Rhodes.
Come here, Dustin. I want everybody to bear with me just for a minute. I want to talk to my son in front of the whole world. When you were born, when you were a baby, when you were born, I went off to seek my fame and fortune. I neglected you. Then later on, when I became World's Heavyweight Champion, I neglected you. Then lately I became this corporate cowboy, if you will, in public with a suit and tie on, and I neglected you. And when it came down to choose a partner, I was off in Hollywood, and I neglected you. Let me tell you something. Buckhouse Buck, let me tell you, Colonel Parker, they all nothing but chicken thieves. That's all they are, brother. Let me tell you something else. Terry Funk is nothing but a low-life, watermelon thief, egg-sucking dog. And let me tell you something about Arn Anderson. Arn Anderson, my son, offered up his innocence, and you paid him back in scorn. The hell with you, Arn Anderson. Anderson has never been nothing but a walk behinder, and when you walk behind and you're not a leader, then the view never changes, baby. The view never changes, baby. The view never changes. You have the ability to be the world's heavyweight wrestling champion. There is not a greater athlete at your age in this sport. But I would ask your favor. I want to ask your favor in front of God and the whole world. I know that the Clash of Champions on August the 24th, you put your name on the dotted line. I don't want you to look for another partner. I don't want you to go and find another man. I don't want you to go out and get on your knees and beg another scum-sucking pig to be your partner. I'm asking you if you can tear this old out of shape, old bent out, old spindly legged man. I want to be your partner. I don't need no handshake, because out there right now tonight there's people with their brothers and their sisters and their wives. They are blood. The Kennedys were blood. The Earps were blood. The Rhodes are blood. I don't need a handshake. What I need now from you is just a hug and a kiss to seal the deal, baby.
And And the promo and the clash leading up to that match is just epic, with Dusty and Dustin reuniting, and then they go to the bar and find the Nasties. So that's one of my favorites. 96 and 97, both really good. You got Sting, the fake Sting in 96, and then 97 where they Kurt Hennig turns on Flair, and they kind of peter from there. But, I mean, that's at least like six really, really damn good fucking War Games matches that they put on. And it's just, to me, it's like the signature WCW gimmick.
Yeah, so it's a big, big fan of War Games. I've got some War Games thoughts. I'm going to keep them in because I'm talking about individual War Games. But yeah, I'll give my thoughts about War Games later on.
Sure. Well, I mean, is War Games 92 one of them? Because I could save my thoughts until
Yeah. We'll save it for then. So we'll move on then to my one. So my number nine is Ron Simmons becoming world champion in 92. Mm. And the one thing that people don't realize is how he actually got the title shot. So we had Sting and Vader were supposed to have a match on a house show, and that was cancelled because Jake Roberts kayfabe injured Sting. So what happened was Bill Watts, who was the WCW president at the time, responded by holding a raffle to determine the number one contender. So I'm not sure how this raffle happened.
Did you have to purchase tickets for the raffle?
That's what I was thinking. Yeah, purchase tickets. I mean, I thought the gambler would have been all over that. Someone like him getting all the tickets, gambling his, you know, to get a title shot. But yeah, it was Simmons who won the raffle, and he defeated Vader with that really awesome looking snap scoop power slam to win the title. And that's when all the baby faces rushed the ring. The crowd went wild. It was just a really good moment. It was put over as the first black champion. We know he wasn't. That was, you know, for me, Bearcat Wright in the 60s, I would say, was the first recognized world champion. But yeah, definitely the first African-American WCW world champion anyway. And it was a big deal still in 92. It's sad that, you know, we say this, that even in the 90s, that, you know, in the WWF or WCW, you didn't have a major single title holder that was, African-American. But yeah, it was a really good for me at the time to, you know, see this. I watched this pretty much in real time. Ron Simmons, I thought, was a great power wrestler. I was a big fan of him. So yeah, it was thumbs up for me. It was a great moment.
For a waist lock. And Vader's got him up. Oh, went over his back. Good agility by Simmons. And Simmons, he got him in a power slam. He got him in a power slam. He got it. Simmons got it. Simmons has won the match. Simmons is a champion. Simmons has won the world title.
Ladies and gentlemen, the winner and the WCW World Heavyweight Champion.
Yeah, I actually have pretty clear memory of that. I remember being in a hotel room somewhere. And, I mean, I only would have been like 11. So we must have been on vacation. I remember having like Saturday night on when they announced that Simmons had defeated Vader, and they showed the lottery in the segment. And I just, it's one of my first like really clear WCW memories for some reason. I just remember being in a hotel room bed. But yeah, great moment. A little bit out of left field. Parv, you could probably talk more to it because you and Chad watched like that whole run. Did the Simmons win kind of come out of nowhere for Ron Simmons, or do you feel like he organically was put in that position?
I actually think they missed the boat on Ron Simmons. The moment they should have pulled the trigger is when he was feeding with Lex Luger, like a little bit like tail end of 91. Mm-hmm. They have a pretty decent, that's a pretty good feud, that Lex Luger one, when I think Luger was the champ. And they don't pull the trigger then. And when he actually finally does get the belt, we've talked about this, but they kind of do something weird where they make the belt feel like mid-card.
Right.
And, he faces off against people like the Barbarian. And, like, it feels like the belt is weirdly downgraded during that period rather than treated like the main deal. And wasn't that when the NWA title was still knocking around as well?
What, in 91 or 92?
No, in 92, like, they have...
The Great Muta was involved with the NWA title, and I think around this time, Barry Windham was into 93.
They have that whole thing where like Vader and Sting take all the main events, even though Simmons is the champ. So it never feels like he's the top guy in the company, even though he's holding the belt, which is, I guess, a criticism of the booking more than anything else. So. I think they should have, if he was ever going to win the belt and for it to feel big, they should have done it kind of tail end of 91. By the time Bill Watts pulls the trigger on it, it's almost like the ship has sailed. And it's almost like from the minute he has the belt, they're looking to get it off him again. You know what I mean? It's just, he feels like a placeholder champ. which is not to take away from, I guess, this racial significance and all the rest of it. But that's just my personal feeling with how they, like, if he was looking to recapture JYD again from what he did in Mid-South, this did not, like, it clearly did not work from that point of view.
No, and it's quite interesting. You know, we used to talk on Letters from Kayfabe Pal about how world champions had fallen, like Ron Garvin. Well, here's an early example is Ron Simmons. He's wrestling, you know, in Flagholm, Pennsylvania for ECW 2 years later, you know, in front of 500 people. You know, he's, you know, he pretty much disappeared from mainstream and then reappeared with the Farouk gimmick, you know, Farouk Assad in 96 with that stupid gladiator helmet in WWF.
Yeah, he actually got good mileage out of that APA thing. Like, I feel like if anyone has two careers, it's Ron Simmons, isn't it? It's like,
yeah.
It really feels like the second his later run feels like it almost feels like a different guy in a way. Like, do you know what I mean? It's hard, yeah. I find it hard to connect this Ron Simmons who wins the belt in 92 with that Ron Simmons who's like the badass in the APA.
Oh, the Doom Ron Simmons as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does feel like a whole completely different person. That gladiator gear, like, changed the whole look of Ron Simmons permanently. He was a whole different person.
Yeah, managed by Sonny as well in his powder blue tights. Yeah, it wasn't a good look. So that's me for Ron Simmons. So on to you then, Parv.
So is this number 8?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay, so this is when, specifically at Clash of the Champions 10, there's a moment where Sting walks out with the Horseman. And he's walking down the aisle, and you just know there is no way he's going to last long with a group. I think they do like an interview with Terry Funk, and it's like this: Flair's the champ, and Sting is, I don't know, the top contender, even though he's one of the Horsemen. And I find this hilarious because of how obvious it is. Like, if you're Sting, you should be able to see this coming a mile off. That the Horsemen are going to turn on you.
Let me just say one thing, Terry. When we have an opportunity to get together on national television, we always make a statement. And tonight, once again, the Horsemen are going to make a statement. And on behalf of the Horsemen, the spokesman, Ole Anderson, has a few words.
We want to make sure that everybody all around the country has an opportunity to hear what I'm about to say. And I want you in particular to pay attention to it, Sting, because you're the reason we're here tonight. I want you to know you're not going to be a horseman anymore. It's over. No more horseman for the Sting. Yeah, don't close your mouth a second. I'm going to explain something to you. I want everybody to listen real close, and you listen real close. When Rick called me and called Arn to come in here, it was for one reason. And the reason he called us in here was to get rid of you. Well, I tell you, now just be quiet. There's three of us standing here, and there's one of you. Just wait a second. One thing that nobody looked for and nobody could figure was when you jumped in and helped Rick against this guy. We held off. A little later, in the Iron Man contest, we came in that ring and we were ready to stick your head in the sand again. And as we came through the ring, Rick gave us this, pay attention, Rick gave us that sign and waved us off. You were spared for the second time. And then something that nobody would have ever dreamed could happened when you became one of us, a horseman. And you were a good horseman, no argument about it. You're a great wrestler, you're a tough, strong kid, but you did the one unforgivable thing that we can never forget. You know what that was? When you signed that match to meet Ric Flair for the world title on February 25th, you signed your death warrant. You listen now. I'm going to tell you what I said to Rick. We all agreed we should just stop you right now, but Rick says, no. Now, he helped me one time. We let him live one time, but on one condition. And the condition is this. You go to the promoter, you go to Mr. Jim Ross or whoever you got to talk to, and you tell him that you're going to cancel that contract with this man. Wait a minute, get over here, Pat. You just listen.
You're taking it too far.
No, you listen to me, and you listen real good. Anybody, even a blind man, can see there's three of us and there's only one of you. We're going to spare your life. You got about 2 hours to make up your mind what you're going to do. And I'm telling you right now, it's only because of his nice kindness that we're going to let you live right here. 2 hours, you make up your mind, you go tell Ross, you tell everybody in the world on this national TV that you're going to give up that chance at the world title. You understand?
Not a chance.
Sting, I bought you a little time because of what you've done.
Nah, you're too easy. The whole deal is this. You got 2 hours to make up your mind, and you're no longer a horseman. And if we ever see you again, you're not going to be quite so lucky as you are tonight.
Wait a minute. Wait, this doesn't make any sense. Hey, wait a minute. I want to go.
Come on.
One of the reasons I really like this, because it sets a tone for literally the next decade. It's hilarious how many times this would happen. Sting has got to be the stupidest person in history. And I think the Horsemen do it again in 1995 when was it Sting and Pillman versus Arn and Flair. They turn on him again.
And that was even more blatant. And Sting actually acknowledges at that time, right? He's like, if you screw me, I'm going to kill you. He knows it's coming that time, and he still falls for it. And they just... I love when Flair just turns on him in that one, too, because it's so fucking... Like, you just know it's coming. They tease the Flair injury. He comes out. He's waiting for the tag. Gets the tag. Comes to the ring. Turns around and bops Sting. It's like, yeah, everyone knew it was coming, but it's still... It's one of those things, like, sometimes the most obvious way to do things is the best, and they didn't try to do any other kind of... They just did what they should have done, and it was still awesome the way they did it.
Yeah. So, I guess the concept would be the obviousness of Flair and Arn turning on Sting whenever they can.
Right. I mean, what's wrong with... I mean, poor old Sting, he sees the good in everybody, you know, when he gets shit on every single time. I mean, what a nice guy Sting was, and, you know, to be treated like that by so many of his so-called friends till the end, just sickening in my eyes.
Have you guys covered the whole Sting-Lex relationship? Because that's one for the ages as well.
No, we haven't done that yet. That could be a whole episode.
We should do that. Yeah, that's definitely a roller coaster of a relationship between those two.
Yeah, especially like the 96 stuff with them is so good. I mean, just so good. With Luger, you know, pretending that, you know, when Sting's turned toward the fans, Luger has this grouse on his face. And then when Sting turns around, he's all smiles and clapping hands. And he's basically like, he still worked with the Dungeon of Doom, but he's saying he's not. But Sting defends him because they're friends. It's so nuanced for that era of WCW. It's amazing that was actually coinciding with the Triple Cage and the Dungeon of Doom, because that's like the simplest form of stupidity that you could have in wrestling. And it's going with this like complex friendship storyline, like hand in hand. It was bizarre.
Just to go back to this situation in 1990 again, that there are other elements to it I want to pull out as well. One of the things that occurred to me during Where the Big Boys Play was that Sting's like personality, if you were to describe it, is basically that of a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle. Like he's basically like he's got the exact personality of a turtle. And he's hanging out with Ole Anderson in 1990, the grumpiest old man in history. Like, there's just the contrast between the three of them and Sting in that group is ridiculous. Like, there's just like I don't know. It must be the most obvious. Like, one of these things is not like the other, and it's not going to last. So that's what I love about it.
Yeah, anyway, you can imagine after the show, they're all getting in the Cadillacs and things, and Sting's there getting on his skateboard. Off he goes to the pizza parlor.
Cowabunga, dude!
For his Michelangelo ice cream pizza that I remember I asked my dad to try and find in the grocery store, because it was on the cartoon, and someone at school convinced me there was an ice cream pizza, which I now know that there is. You can make this sort of shit now, and it's more dessert type, but this is a pizza that you could put in the oven that didn't melt, and I believed him. And I told my dad to go and find it, and I think my dad just humoured me and said, yeah, I'll go in there.
I should have disowned you. That's what I would have done. But it's almost like Ole was like Sting's grandfather, that he was like, he had to hit, like, babysit him, and he's bringing him out with his friends, and he's just like, you know, this like this detachment in eras, and Oli and his friends are trying to take care of business, and Sting's there fucking around this goofy Ninja Turtle. But no, that's a pretty funny comparison.
So what's your next one, JT?
All right, so my number eight is more of a time period, and that's the 1997-98 undercard of WCW, and it was a pretty big like talking point on the internet and point of angst for many too. Is that undercard is so loaded, and they are just filling hours and hours and volumes of TV and pay per view with these great matches, random combinations where every week they could have a different match if they wanted to, and it could be great and unique. You know, I mean, they just pair these guys up, and of course it was during this time, especially in 98. Where they weren't really elevating a lot of the guys. They were just kind of all stuck in neutral for the most part. And it, of course, becomes super evident with the Jericho-Goldberg feud. There was a one-sided feud where Jericho's just running it on his own. But they had so much talent that just week after week made the shows tolerable and watchable and really good at times, even though there was a lack of focus or direction by 98. And it was still the old stale guard on top. But it was still worth checking out because they had this great plethora of talent that they could just pull from at any time, whether it was hour two of Saturday Night, you know, Power Hour, hour two of Nitro, hour one of Thunder. Like, there was always, like, quality matches out there. And it's, I guess, in some ways maybe similar to modern-day WWE, where they're just kind of loaded with these mid-card talent that can just go out there and put matches on. They're not as willy-nilly as WCW was to just throw out matches and let them go for 10 minutes, but it reminds me of it when you look at the depth of the roster right now. But WCW was just brimming and loaded with talent before they all started jumping ship in 99 when the wheels started to come off. But for that two-year period, they had arguably one of the best rosters in wrestling history when you look at that era.
Oh, completely. It was a completely varied roster as well. You know, mm-hmm. we had every single shape and size and, you know, different talents of you know, backgrounds and things. So that was cool. I've just thought of something, not really to do with this, but just kind of the presentation in WCW. Have you ever noticed that in WWF, they announce the matches with the ring announcer and the wrestlers come down? In WCW, the ring announcers a lot of the time were muted, and you just have the commentary team just having a chat, you know, during this. And then they would say, Bobby Eaton's, you know, in the ring now, ready to face Sting, or, you know, whatever. It was in the presentation that was slightly different. It's just something that's just dawned on me to talk about. I don't know why I've interjected now when you were talking about what you were, JT, but I just thought it was a point I wanted to make.
I was always weird, too, how they'd always start the next guy's music before the first guy didn't come all the way down the aisle. Like, WWF, the entrances are such a big part of the program. Like, they didn't end that music till that first guy was in the ring, did his posing, his, you know, everything. He comes out, waves to the crowd, and then it would start the second entrance. But WCW was almost like an afterthought. Like, there'd be a guy would be halfway down the aisle, and they'd already be starting the next song for the next guy to come out. It was always kind of weird.
Yeah, I noticed that as well. So, any good memories of the mid-card in that era, Parv?
Yeah, well, just on the presentation front, the thing I always remember is I guess it's famous now, but the looking down the barrel of the camera. That is something that they always did in WCW. Mm-hmm. The guy would be walking down the aisle, and he'd take the camera and he'd say something straight to you. That never happened in WF. So that was another kind of presentational, different feel. My main memory of this era, especially of the undercard, is that this is, I guess, when I was born, or when I first discovered all this, when I first got online and discovered all the smart terminology and all this. And I remember all the talking points at that time was like, oh, isn't it terrible? You know, Hogan's in the main event and you've got a talent like Dean Malenko there. Why isn't Dean Malenko in the main event?
Like, right.
Those are the sorts of talking points on, you know, Scott Keith and all those guys.
many still persist today, but yes.
You know what I mean, though? It's like, yeah. Oh, you've got a talent like, Malenko is the one that always sticks in my mind. But
Well, then like, PWI didn't help when they put him number one that year in the PWI 500.
but it was the whole kind of, I do think some of those criticisms were valid. Like, looking back, I always feel like that generation of mid-card stars in WCW, some of them, I guess, got kind of main event-y runs in the WWF, but I kind of feel like Hogan and that whole generation of 80 stars, Savage and to an extent Sting, and they didn't put that younger generation over. And I still think that the stars who came from that generation don't feel like they were ever as big stars as the previous generation or the subsequent one. Do you know what I mean by that? Like,
yeah.
I Edge is always the one that sticks in my mind. Like, I'll never see Edge as like a top star. Or like Chris Jericho is another good example. Been around for years. Good solid upper mid card talent.
But look at
hard to see him as like a Hogan or a Savage or even a Piper, you know what I mean?
And even if you want to say that they eventually got there, it took like 5 years in WWF or E to get them there. You know what I mean? Like Eddie and Benoit come in January of 2000, and it's not until like 04 that they feel they're ready to be top dogs on the program. And even then it's with a split brand where they're, you know, not really leading the promotion. And then even Jericho, yes, he wins the Undisputed title at the end of 01, but it's really not till he went away and came back and like refined his look into that Nick Bockwinkel kind of where he felt like a more of a tippy toppy guy. But even then, it's still not the, like you're saying, not the Hogan Savage, Austin level.
Two examples I would give are DDP and Booker T.
Yeah.
Now, like they got to the very top of the card, but I still, like, looking back, I cannot see them as anything but tier two. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
In terms of the pen, to the extent that even when I look back to the kind of the late 80s, early 90s era, I even think like your second tier stars there, like a Rick Rude or a DiBiase, say, even in my mind, still feel like bigger stars than the top stars of that came out of that generation. Yeah.
I'm impressed, Parv, sorry to jump in. I'm impressed. It's only taken you about 40 minutes to mention Ted DiBiase on this episode. So well done.
I have to mention him.
I'm waiting for Ted DiBiase managing the Steiners to be number one.
I was going to say his run with the Steiners is not on my list. So.
it's interesting. To me, I think, you know, when you say the guys like Booker and DDP, I would say that the two guys that felt like the biggest stars in the dying days were Steiner and Goldberg.
Now, last week, I was watching TV, and I watched a 53-year-old man come out here who has more loose skin than a Shar Pei puppy come out here and say he's still the man. I seen Ric Flair, number two, the Nature Boy, come out here who's been the butt end of all the jokes because he's supposed to be the limousine riding, jet flying son of a gun. But I'm saying one time, you should have took a cab and used that money to fix your crooked yellow teeth. So I had to ask myself, if WCW was going to hire the Nature Boy number two, why wouldn't they hire the Nature Boy, the original Nature Boy, Buddy Rogers? Now, I don't know that Buddy Rogers is dead, God rest his soul, but Ric Flair, your career is dead. And I know as he lays 6 feet under, he's still styling and profiling, because when you used your little brain and stole his name, there's one thing you couldn't steal, and that was his class. So when you walked down that aisle last week, I know I wasn't alone, because the people at home, all they did was grab their remote, change the channel to the WWF, and watch Stone Cold, a person you and your old friends got fired from here, because you're a jealous old bastard. So Ric Flair, remember this, in this wrestling business, there's never been a bigger ass-kissing, butt-sucking bastard in this business, but also in life, you're the biggest ass-kissing, backstabbing, butt-sucking bastard. And you belong where you're at in WCW, because WCW sucks. And so do you, me. I'm just going to stand right here in the NWO for life.
And Goldberg went over Hogan and a bunch of guys, and Steiner had been around forever. You know, I mean, they kind of built up his name and image by then. So to me, they always came up with they came up off as the biggest stars.
Well, look at Goldberg. He went like, they put him over at least. He beat people. Do you know what I mean? So that it goes to show what I was. It's really on the talent not doing the jobs when they should have done at that point in their career.
So.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely agree. And I can agree with you that people perceived them, including myself, as second-tier talents, your Booker T's and your DDP's later on with WCW. So my number eight is the Samoan SWAT team. Just the Samoan SWAT team in the 89 jobber run. Yep. All those matches they had there where they were killing, I think, was it Lee Scott was the hapless jobber that would get backdropped and nearly land on his head every single week on WCW TV tapings. I mean, those guys would just absolutely decimate jobbers. I'm going to have to make a gift collection of this because there is some, you know, seeing is believing. I don't know, you know, you see yourself as a jobber, you turn up for a TV tape and you see against these guys and you just think, oh, shit. But yeah, they had a really good one. They were really positioned really strongly. But the one thing that always irked me about the Samoan SWAT team, when they just randomly changed themselves to the New Wild Samoans at the back end of 89, where you had the Samoan Savage replacing Samu, and there was no real reason given. But with Fatu and Samu, and they were managed by Big Daddy Dink, I think, and before that it was Paulie Dangerously they were brought in. I think they were really fun on these squash matches, and it was really, you know, going back and revisiting all them is an absolute pleasure here. A lot of fun to be had. Not a lot of fun for the jobbers, but a lot of fun for me as the viewer.
Well, yeah, all-time squash, yeah. Guys. Go ahead, Parf.
Well, one of my big talking points watching this on, God, it must have been a few years ago now on where the big boys play, but is that Samu is actually a really, really good worker, like all through that run.
Mm-hmm.
I actually feel like he's the more seasoned guy. Like he's a little bit better than Fatu if you watch the matches closely. When they bring in Samoan Savage, I don't know what happens to him because he was actually like, was he Haku's partner back in the day, that guy, Samoan Savage?
Yeah, that was Tama. Is it Tama?
Or was it the random third islander that comes in?
I don't think it's him.
No, it is Tama, because something happens to him. He is terrible in that run when he comes back, the Samoan Savage. So if you look at the changes they make, trading up or trading down, Samu to Samoan Savage is a terrible change, because Samoan Savage is, I don't know what happens to him, but he's put on about 60 pounds and he's rubbish. What Paulie Dangerously to Big Daddy Dink. Ah, if you want to talk about my least favorite managers of all time, there's him, Humpet, like terrible manager. So
a human cheese puff.
Don't they have a feud with the Midnights, I want to say, in 89?
Yeah, it was because it was the original Midnight Express who left the promotion, and then the Samoans also took over the Midnight Express's feud with the normal Midnight Express, the original one. And I think they had a match at Clash, one of the Clashes, if memory serves me right. But they were also involved in the War Games, if you remember, in 89. There was, yep, like Terry Gordy in that. And so they had a good little run. And then they had the Samoan Savage came in, and then they had that Starcade, who's going to be the team of the 90s with the World Warriors. Was it Doom and the Steiners?
Steiners, yeah.
Yeah, so they're involved there as well. And then they parlayed Samu and Fatu into being the hedge rinkers, which, again, they killed jobbers a lot in 92, 93 in WWF. But yeah,
the squashes in that era are unbelievable. Like those Raw, early Raws are carried by them and the Steiners, just destroying jobbers. And yeah, it was Tama. So yeah, he really fell off a cliff, because he's fantastic in WWF in the 80s with Haku. And then, yeah, he just isn't the same when he goes to WCW with the SWAT team. No, it's a great choice, Alan. Obviously, a ton of fun, and just, you know, I'm all about anyone who's beats the shit out of jobbers for 5 minutes at a clip. So,
right, Parv, what's your number seven?
My number seven is it's the moment when, and I have mentioned where the big boys play a lot this evening, but possibly the most fun I've ever had on a podcast. I remember it really well because I happened to be recording it on a Christmas period back at my parents' house. So I wasn't recording in the usual place. And it was Chad's rant about the Black Scorpions doing magic tricks with the head in the box. The level of anger from Chad, because he couldn't make head, like, what's the point of this? It's not funny. It doesn't draw money. It doesn't get you interested. It makes Sting look stupid. So it's specifically the moment where the Black Scorpion's head is in that box and it turns around in that. Do you remember the moment?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we
covered some of the Black Scorpion about a month ago or so on the show. And some of the magician tricks were really, really poor. I actually mentioned on this, and it's something you might be interested in, Parv, is there's a podcast called the 605 Podcast, which is run by the great Brian Last, is the host of that. It's a really good podcast. But they actually found and interviewed the magician who was, you know, brought in to do all those tricks and supervise everything around that run. It's quite an interesting insight into what WCW was trying to achieve around that time. So I'll send you a link to that after the show, I think.
What were they trying to achieve? Because I still don't. I mean,
he didn't know. The magician didn't know.
It's such a bizarre, and like all along we're meant to believe it's Flair doing the magic. It's so awful.
Dumb. The whole thing's dumb. It's clear. I mean, it's clear that they had an idea, and then it didn't come to fruition, and then they were just confused. And the original stuff wasn't bad. Like, you know, again, when we rehashed Allen, we talked about it a ton. But I mean, the original stuff where the Scorpion is like a guy from Sting's past, and he's mad that Sting went on to glory and he hasn't, and he's going to come and take him out and steal his life. Like, that was okay. Like, it started well, and then just all of a sudden falls apart into where he's not just this mysterious man from the past. He's legitimately just like this dark magician, and he's out there doing black magic on TV, but it's not even black magic. It's literally, you know, moving a person from one side of the arena to another. You know, this is the cheesiest parlor tricks possible. And then they just give up in his flair.
And at one point it was Chad's favorite wrestler, Al Perez, right?
We debunk that one, I think, because Al Perez, if you look at if you go like a history of WWE or you go on to Cage Match, you'll see he pretty much started the tail end of it was with WWF at this point, really, wasn't he? I think we established JT, if memory serves me correctly.
Yeah, I think so.
So we debunked that one, unfortunately, for you.
You're saying that Clash 12, it wasn't Al Perez?
No.
Who played the Black Scorpion in Clash 12, then?
Well, there was different people. I haven't got my notes in front of me, but we did cover it on the show, and there's about eight different, you know, guys who worked as the Black Scorpion at one time or another. But I'm pretty sure, 95% sure, Al Perez wasn't one of them.
Wow. Well, that's a bit of a bomb for me. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, if you
listen
to the show,
we're breaking hot news on this show. 30 years later,
Parv, you need to listen to the shows, Parv. You'll learn something.
I need to go back and. I don't want to labour this, but did you guys come up with a theory as to who it was meant to be if it wasn't Flair? Like, who else could it be?
It's supposed to be.
I was just going to say, I'm going to bring up the notes now. I think I've still got them. I think we went with the Angel of Death was one of the guys, wasn't it? Because was he also involved in Power Team USA, the whole thing in California with Warrior? But it was supposed to be, not supposed to be, but they hinted it was going to be Warrior. But how absurd was that, like JT said? The WWF champion at the time, just going to jump ship, you know, work a program with Sting, you know, in WCW, the lesser promotion.
I definitely think I think it was going to be Angel of Death, and they wanted you to think it was going to be Warrior, so you would buy in. I think it was basically the same shit they did with Renegade all those years later, where they teased it and teased it and wanted you to think it was Ultimate Warrior, and then they knew all along it wasn't going to be. So
can you imagine how shit that would have been if it was Angel of Death? They would have been like, who? This guy from, like, world class?
Awful.
What? It would have been... So maybe Flair was the best option.
Yeah, I think so. At the time, they booked themselves into a corner. But guys who played him, there was a guy, a jobber called Jeff Ellis, who had Wild Bill Irwin, David Sheldon, Stan Payne, Matt the Cowboy Hunter, Jumping Joey Maggs, and Randy Cully, who was Moondog Rex. They all played him at one time or another on TV.
Amazing.
And Flair. All right. And Flair with his mullet. Awful. All right.
I think Chad gave Flair, like, you know, the match they have? I want to say he gave him the MVP for that show, like for the match he worked as Black Scorpion, because of how much he changed his style.
Right. Flair, to the end, Flair was the only guy who cared. Like, all of that shit. He's the only one who gave a shit to, like, try to make things work ever in WCW. All right, my number seven, and again, something we've touched on and off a lot, and on other shows as well, WCW is outside of the box thinking and ideas. I always loved how varied and different they would be. Like, WWF is always very standard, at least for big, like, chunks of eras. WCW is not against just mixing things up and doing different stuff, whether it was going to Hog Wild, that one Sturgis, having a show on the beach, doing the holiday themed pay-per-views like Halloween Havoc, where everyone's in costume, but, you know, bringing in the celebrity, like, just everything was out. They always were looking for different ideas to mix things up. They weren't afraid to not have a standardized look. And I mean, you can argue whether or not it made sense or it worked. Like, obviously one of them still in business and the other isn't, but, I appreciate their attempts to be not just a kind of bland looking promotion, that they tried to do different things and have different ideas and concepts and gimmicks. And when I say gimmicks, I mean gimmick matches, like spin the wheel, make the deal, and just stuff like that. Like, they always tried to do things a little bit varied or different. It wasn't as standard or cookie cutter as WWF tended to be for much of their existence.
Yeah, and they had the ramp as well, which I was always a big fan of, the ramp going, you know, connecting to the ring, which, Parv, you've watched a load of the old WWF house shows. Was that what they used to have at the Montreal Forum, or was it Toronto?
Toronto.
It was somewhere
in
Canada.
I feel like it's the Canadian one. Where they
it was Toronto. Yeah, it was Toronto.
Yeah, it was Toronto. So it was a different look for WWF, but WCW did this from, I'd say, 1990 up to 95. I think they had the kind of thing that connected the entranceway. So yeah, it was I like that look, that part of the kind of presentation. So Parv, what for you? What separated when as young Parv? What separated WWF from WCW for you?
I got to think about that. I always had this sense that WCW was like the lower leagues or like the second. It didn't feel as big time.
Always, yeah.
So I always had that sense, not in the Monday Night Wars era, but like, even into that a little bit, mm-hmm. I still in my heart of hearts felt that the big leagues was the WWF, even when Hogan and stuff were in the other place. And there are reasons for that. Like, I want to say WCW went outside more. So like you get more like sunshine and things like that. And WF feels darker somehow. Do you know what I mean? Like it's more indoors more of the time, and so it's kind of a lit. Do you know what I mean by that? Like they kind of. I feel like WCW moves into different locations more.
Yes. Yep.
When I think back to it, whereas WWF always seems to maintain a really standard look through the. I mean. On Letters from Kayfabe Allen, we track the distinct looks over the era.
Yeah.
But when you're in an era, you can kind of tell.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Everything looks the same.
I feel like this is what I'm trying to get at. WCW feels like it's connected to the real world a bit more.
Mm-hmm.
It's like rooted in like what we were talking about earlier, like malls or, you know, they had that bloody hog wild thing where all the bikers would come, or, you know, bloody Hogan fighting on the roof against the giant, all this sort of stuff. You know, the bloody, what was that? The Dustin Rhodes match on the truck.
Yeah, that was it. Uncensored in 95. Yeah.
So I just feel like it's more like in real life America versus WWF, which always feels like its own self-contained weird little universe.
Right.
And even when a celebrity comes into Vince's world, they incorporate him into that world, as opposed to, like, I don't know, Jason Hervey wave for the camera type thing. You know what I mean? It's just a different thing.
Yeah, no, you're right. They've almost become part of the show, whereas WCW, they embrace more of what that star does outside versus WWF. Like WrestleMania 11, like Jonathan Taylor Thomas is on. Like, we don't care that he was the Lion King or Improvement or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, he's in this world now, WrestleMania 11. And that's, I only use that because I just watched the Raw leading up to it. But it's very much that feeling. Like, we're not exiting WWF. They're entering this parallel universe.
The one thing I wanted to quickly mention about WCW's presentation was the kind of, you know, WWE, the either had a curtain you'd come out through. WCW's was like something from a low rent, and Parv might get this term. You know, if you watched Phoenix Night, Parv, or Working Men's Club, you know, you had the spangly stuff that they walk through. You know, what's the best way to describe that to JT is like kind of really low rent, like magicians would kind of pop out of it at
right.
a kids' party.
Yep.
The silver, you know, the stuff that they walk through. I don't know what it's called. Silvery string? I don't know.
Tinsel? Yeah. It's not tinsel, is it? It's kind of...
It's something similar to tinsel, though, yeah.
Yeah, well, that stuff. That was really, I thought, low rent for them. But yeah, that was WCW 91, I think.
One of the things I wanted to mention is to just get into some of the reasons for those differences that JT was talking about in a creative. Why did WCW always have so many different ideas, whereas WF feels like much more controlled environment? And I think part of it is Dusty. You have to say that Dusty was just like an ideas generation unit. And, you know, either the ideas would be the best thing ever or they'd be terrible. But he'd try them all. So that's part of it. The other thing is that whole thing of booking by committee that they did all through the years in WCW. Like, even under Eric Bischoff, you know, it was Kevin Sullivan. It was all sorts of different people had creative input, which has got pros and cons. Like, the pro is that you get to see all sorts of stupid ideas, like spin the wheel, make the deal, or... Well, wherever it is over the years, the con is that things are jettisoned a lot more quickly, I feel. Like, so, I don't know, like, Bill Watts must have had an idea of making the tournament at Starcade mean something. They did it for 2 years and then they canned the idea. So there's a lot of, like, traditions and things that are started that are never finished in WCW. Whereas I feel like if Vince has this idea, right, I don't know, we want to make the Andre the Giant thing happen every year, he'll make it happen, right, even if nobody likes it.
And I think there's two glaring reasons for that. One is that WF is solely Vince, right? I mean, he just makes the decisions, he'll do whatever the fuck he wants. WCW, there's a lot more cooks in the kitchen when it comes to ideas. Like, there was never really... They may have had a lead booker, but they just had so many people to answer to and so many levels of hierarchy that it was never just like one guy calling the shots and forcing his will. The other one is that Vince, I think, was just, at least in that time period, much more money adverse, like, or risk adverse. You know what I mean? Like, he had his methods. He knew how he was going to make money and turn profits, and he wasn't going to waste money on frivolous ideas or things. Like, he wasn't going to go run a free show on a giant beach, because why the fuck would he do that? Like, you know, why are we not going to make money on the show? So I think that was a part of it. Now, they get a little bit more freewheeling with their money once they become a, you know, billion-dollar operation in the early 2000s or whatever, when they go public and they start destroying cars and stuff like that more openly. But there's a stretch there just in throughout the 90s where he's just very much, you know, bare bones. This is what we're doing. This is what we're going to be. I'm not doing stupid things that aren't going to make us money.
No, and I think that's a fair point. So I think, yeah, the presentation is an interesting thing that, you know, throughout the years in WCW, we did talk on it to a degree, that the different sets that they had on a previous episode, Parv. So, you know, they do Nitros, you know, Spring Break, and they'd throw wrestlers into the pool. Was it, who was it who got powerbombed into the pool? Was it Scott Hall, or I can't remember? It might have been Kevin Nash, I don't know.
I think every year someone got thrown in that pool, yeah.
Yeah, so they did lots of different things like that. That's why I liked WCW at the time. So that's hopefully that one. So is it me now for number 7?
I think so.
Yep.
Yeah, it's me. So I think my number 7 is the whole Loose Cannon Brian Pillman. Tail end of 95 up until 96, where he managed to be the master manipulator in it all, get out of his contract, start a bidding war, get a sweet deal with the WWF, even when he had a broken ankle and it was all messed up from that Hummer accident. But, you know, leading up to that, the whole thing with the Horseman, where he'd be acting out and you'd have Arn Anderson slapping him down, you know, he'd be trying to goad people, and just the whole angle was that convincing. It worked the boys. You know, you're that good in a character, you know, that can do that. I think that's a special talent. And it was such a memorable era, because this is kind of the melding of the internet, or the kind of shoot comments that we'd not really seen before on a mainstream level. We'd seen smaller things like this, a regional level. The USWA would do the kind of close to the bone things from time to time. But, you know, in WCW in 95 to do something like this, when we were well in the Hogan era still, I think it was really interesting. So you had him running around with the Horsemen, and it all culminated really with getting Bobby Heenan to swear on live TV, and also then at the Clash, and then at the Super Bowl was the Kevin Sullivan "I Respect You, Booker Man" thing, where, you know, I think Tony Schiavone didn't have a clue what was going on commentary, and I thought it's just awesome. It's just completely, you don't know what to expect from a guy like that. And if I was watching in real time, but if I was watching Nitro and Raw live every week, if in America, if I was in the US, that I would just be tuning into Nitro every week, because I just wouldn't know what was going to happen with Pillman. It would just make for interesting television for me.
Ladies and gentlemen, we haven't seen anything like this in a long time. Someone hit him right in the jaw. He hit him right in the jaw and almost knocked him out. And now he kicks him into the solar plexus. And now I'm thinking about a leather strap right now. Jimmy Jett has a wireless microphone.
And man, I don't think this is what Aretha Franklin meant.
I respect you, Booker man.
Oh, he said, "I respect you."
Bet you. And he walked.
And he walked out.
And he walked.
He said, "I respect you," and he walked out.
Wow.
So Kevin Sullivan, the Taskmaster, will win it. But I mean, for about 45 seconds, we had the darndest fight we'd ever seen. Arn Anderson, who is not even scheduled on the card, but you know,
he was on the golf course today with me.
Well, you know, when Ric Flair is around, Arn Anderson, the Enforcer, is going to be around. So Arn Anderson comes out, and we've got a little problem here.
Yeah, and even that one right before Uncensored, when he comes out with the call 911 shirt or whatever, I think that's his final appearance. That's such a great moment. And then he's supposed to be in the Triple Cage of Doom or whatever it is, and he no-shows that. Yeah, I'm with you. That's one of my all-time favorite characters. I'm a massive Pillman fan, as many know. And that stretch, to me, it all kicks off with that match with Johnny B. Badd at Fall Brawl, because that match is awesome. And he starts to show some heel tendencies there. And then it kind of just builds and builds from there. And I love the tag with him and Arn against Flair and Sting when he turns. I like him helping Arn to beat Flair at a Fall Brawl. And then just from there, I mean, I think that's one of the best horsemen foursomes. At least one of my favorites is Benoit, Pillman, Flair, and Arn. Like, they're not together on TV like enough, because Benoit was kind of in and out of Japan, and then Pillman's gone. But for those few weeks or so when they were like a unit and unified and on, it's one of the best groups. I mean, they didn't really have like that kind of bruiser guy that Mongo would eventually become, but just some pure like in-ring talent and work rate. It's got to be one of the strongest foursomes they ever had. So, that run of Pillman's one of my favorites. And he made a lot of money off it, so good for him.
Yeah, good for him. Parv, did you like that run?
Yeah, and I know what you're saying. Like, how can I put this? There are certain guys who felt like they should be horsemen and certain guys who shouldn't. And Pillman is just one of those guys who felt a correct fit mm-hmm. for the group. But Benoit as well, I would have to say. I guess you're always looking for technical guys to be in the horsemen. So, like, I never bought Sid as a horseman, do you know what I mean? Or Sting, or even when Luger was with a group, you kind of think, is he, like, he's not Barry Windham, is he? Whereas Pillman, I really dug that version of it. We already mentioned how he joined. The loose cannon, like... The other thing with this one, this is when you're kind of getting closer to what you'd call the Attitude Era. And I don't think people give Pillman enough credit for how instrumental he was in that kind of general shift. Like, he was a little bit ahead of the curve, I would say, by about a year.
Like, oh, yeah, definitely.
If you look at what happened.
Yeah, he was definitely like the precursor of it. He was kind of the John the Baptist of the Attitude Era, right? He kind of is warning everyone of what's coming. He's like, he's just a little bit a year ahead, but he's still doing all the stuff that would become so prominent. And I mean, one of the biggest what ifs is what he could have been in like 98 and 99 WWF, because I'm sure he would have been a lot of fun.
Yeah, he should have been. Just getting back to the point you mentioned about having Luger and Sting and people in the Four Horsemen. Part of the Four Horsemen is heel's gimmick in some ways, but part of Four Horsemen in general, because they always end up turning heel, was keep the best guys in the group so they won't go after Flair's title. You know, was some of the idea behind that, I think, as well at some point, was keep your friends close, your enemies closer. And, you know, yeah. For me, I that's a bit of a takeaway from some of the picks that the Horsemen had.
Yeah, no, I can see that, but it's always going to backfire eventually, because they end up having to turn on them when they grow too big, like Sting in 1990. Anyway, yeah.
So we're going on to number six now for you, Parv.
Yeah, my number six is Lord Stephen Regal teaches Bobby Eaton etiquette lessons, how to speak the Queen's English. Dining skills, I guess. This is when Bob Eaton becomes Earl Robert Eaton?
Yes, Earl Robert, yep.
right at the start of the Blue Bloods. I have very fond memories of watching that stuff. It's not just that it's funny to see this kind of quiet Southern guy who's just, you know, obviously not from England, being taught these things.
I hope you don't mind, Robert. I took the liberty of ordering ahead. You do like beef, don't you?
Yeah, I love cheeseburger stuff.
No, this
French
is
fries.
Fine British beef.
Thank you very much, my dear. Thank you.
Well, what about a drop of wine, Robert?
You could have a Boots Farm, a Ripple,
What? No. Why could we have the usual, please? Robert, that doesn't go on your neck. It goes on your lap, please. Oh, my goodness. This is going to be far worse than I ever imagined.
It's also, I think, when Regal really nails the character. Like, if you watch Regal in, like 93, say, he hasn't quite got the character 100%, and I feel like he absolutely nails it during these skits. It's where the I think the Regal character is finalized, and obviously it would go and it would have many different manifestations over the years, but like the basics are down, like the facial expressions, the way he deals with like little moments of comedy. I mean, I think I've said it before. I'd rank Regal up there with the top comedy actors of all time. Mm-hmm. Like,
he's got all his inspirations from Carry On films. I mean, he said that to me himself in person before, that, you know, without you kind of that, those mannerisms and those reactions, he wouldn't, you know, be as popular as he was. And he freely admits that he borrowed so much from it. But do you remember, Parv and JT, when Regal first showed up in WCW in like January 93, just came out, he looked like Parv. He was it Mind? No, not Mind. It was the jacket. Well, anyway, Regal had a leather jacket anyway.
Are you talking about Boone?
Yeah, Boone. There we go. Perfect. Yeah. Sorry, another British reference there, JT. But yeah, he came out with this leather jacket. You'd see a guy in a pub in the UK in that era. And he just taught mild-mannerly that he was a good wrestler and he was going to go for things. And then he obviously turned into Lord Steven Regal and his career went somewhere. Just as plain old Steve Regal, I think he would have, you know, really floundered. So I'm glad that they saddled that gimmick with him, because it, you know, gave him, you know, plenty of years of mileage.
It was great. I liked the Blue Bloods. I thought they were a good, solid mid-card team that could credibly challenge for the titles. I mean, they were up there with Harlem Heat and the Nasties, like, in that feud. They had that three-way on the beach, Bash at the Beach 95, with the three of them. And, yeah, they have a pretty good run. I thought it was a nice bounce for Eaton as well. You know what I mean? It was kind of like, what else is Bobby Eaton going to do in 1995? He's kind of running on fumes. And this gave him a little bit of an extra... Just keeps him going for an extra year or so. Gave him a reason to stick around. Yeah. Right. I mean, obviously, they make a great unit, but it gave him purpose on the roster instead of just kind of getting turfed or pushed out.
Do you think, like, because rather than bringing in Dave Taylor, do you think they could have had a, like, Regal and Eaton had a run as a legit tag team, like, with the titles, like, in the mix?
When would you say that would have been? Like, it'd have been 95 they should have had, or 96? Would you say is that when they should have had the titles?
Probably in 95. Like, who else is around? Like, the what? Like,
Harlem Heat.
Harlem Heat and the Nasties pretty much trade the belts.
Harlem Heat suck. I hate to break it to everyone. But especially, especially if you... Have you gone back and watched those pay-per-views week after week, JT? Like...
Yes.
A lot of those Harlem Heat matches are difficult to sit through for me.
Yeah, they're not. I mean, Booker doesn't really get good until like 98-ish when they're on their last legs as Harlem Heat. And so, I mean, they have that endless feud in 95 with the Nasty Boys. I mean, they fight like a million times. And the Blue Bloods are in the mix. I mean, they get like title matches with those teams. Like, they're up there. They just don't ever get the actual titles. But they're not really treated like a lower class team. If you look at that, like, summer of 95, the Blue Bloods are up there as far as being in the mix and being considered like an upper level team. I think what it came down to after that is that they just wanted to push Regal. You know, they wanted to have him be a solo star. So they kind of come apart. So I don't think it even had anything to do with them not wanting to give them a push. I think they just figured, well, you know, we could be using Regal more as an upper mid-card guy. And by 96, he's in that feud with Sting and everything else. So
It's just me, because I think both Regal and Eaton were like in my top 25 all-time wrestlers. Like, they're both.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
So that would just be an absolute dream team of two completely different styles. And
yeah, they're definitely class acts, aren't they? The one thing for me with the whole feud with the Nasty Boys is the pit stop was a move designed for William Regal to take Steve Regal, you know, from the facial reactions after he's had his head stuffed into Jerry Sags's sweaty armpit. You know, that was perfect for him. So that was, there were good moments in 95 for me.
Yeah, you're right.
All right.
So, JT, what's your number six?
All right, here we go, Alan. You ready to go to war? My number six, the year of 1994 in WCW. My favorite year There's so much good stuff in that first half, and even like I said, the second half not as bad as you may think. I know you think Hogan versus Beefcake at Starrcade makes the whole year null and void, but it's just not true. There's so much fun. I think Super Brawl through Slamboree is arguably maybe the best three pay per view stretch of any company in North American wrestling history. There's so much good on those three shows, and it's you have this wonderful blend of old school WCW, and then you slowly seeing it fall apart by the end of the year. But even that, we're not really fully engrossed in like the Hogan ridiculousness until the very end of the year. Like his stuff with Flair is still pretty good. That match at Bash of the Beach is very good. The match at Havoc is pretty solid. They do the stuff where Hogan getting his knee clipped by the guy in the mat. Like all that stuff is pretty good TV. And then against it all, you have the Rhodes stuff versus Stud Stable, which is just great. You have Vader and Boss just beating the shit out of each other all year long, and Sting gets in the mix on that too. Duggan comes in, and yes, he goes over and squashes Steve Austin, but you know what? He's in really damn good shape and has some good matches, and him versus Vader at Starrcade is really fucking fun, and Vader gets the U.S. title. And that whole year, right up until Hogan and, you know, Butcher at Starrcade, to me, there's a ton of good stuff, and I wish Jesse was around more. That's one of my few things. But even like a guy like Rude kind of has a little bit of a bounce back, like after a soft 93, before he hurts his back and goes out. You got Sting and Flair fighting to unify the titles on the Clash.
Doesn't he grow his mustache back?
He does, yes. It's like Samson growing the hair back.
Lose the mustache, lose it all.
Regains his powers. Sting and Flair have that unification match on the Clash, and right as Flair goes heel and hooks up with Sherry. Flair Steamboat, great match of Spring Stampede, better match on Saturday night to basically clear up the confusion over who's champion. That match is great. If you haven't watched it, go back and relive it.
He's got the legs. One, two, only a two. Flair clinching.
Well, that's what happens when you try those high aerial moves. It's going to backfire on you.
One, two, three.
He got him. He got him.
Ladies and gentlemen, right the winner of the match, the WCW World Heavyweight Champion, Nature Boy, Rick Flair.
For the 12th time.
An even dozen.
I believe it's on YouTube or Daily Motion. Our buddy Tim Capel posted it recently in one of the comment threads on PlaceOfMeNation.com. If you haven't seen that match, go check it out. It's kind of a hidden classic for Flair and Steamboat. It's probably maybe Steamboat's last great match, too. But then you have Steamboat and Austin. They have a really good feud as well throughout 94. So there's some really good stuff. I recommend we did the podcast series, me, Will, Charles, and Scott, back on the PlaceOfMe podcast a few years back. We watched everything from 94 WCW, pay-per-view, and Clash. There's just so much good stuff in there. Just a great quintessential WCW year. Alan, you can shove it.
Paul, we went through when we rated the years 89 through to 2000, and I buried 94, like JT alluded to, just for the Hoganness that seeped into the promotion. And, you know, Starrcade being headlined by Beefcake versus Hogan just nulls everything that went before. I still acknowledge the stuff before, it was awesome, but my final grade, what did I give it, JT? Was it like
something stupid,
E?
Like a D or an F or whatever.
Yeah, I wasn't a fan of it. So yeah, but 94, you know, it was really good year. Joking aside, you know, even up at, you know, the Fall Brawl in 94, the Dusty promo with Dustin, it was all excellent stuff. So I am a fan of 94, but yeah, it's just the end stuff this killed it for me.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about, Alan, because I have a strong emotional response to that Hogan bullshittery that happens. I actually think it's one of the bigger shames how can I put this? We give Eric Bischoff a lot of shit. I actually feel like he was starting to build something interesting there in 93 and 94. Like, I actually think the promotion was pretty good on its own terms. And then they turn it into Dungeon of Doom and all the rest of it. Like, looking back now, we can say it was, you know, it's quite fun. But honestly, some of those shows are so bad that it's not fun in 95. Like, 95 is a very strange year, isn't it? Because it's kind of like some absolutely brilliant things and some of the worst stuff you've ever seen. But I take your point, JT, that 94 is kind of a sleeper year. It's under the radar. Lots of really interesting stuff, like, you know, Duggan looking more on fire than he's been in a decade.
You know? Basically ripped in that run. He was juicing big time.
Yeah, I don't know. I agree with you. I feel like they were building something big, and it's all ruined by that loser Brutus Beefcake. I think that's the if we could pinpoint the precise moment when WCW jumps the shark before the NWO, it's that. Because I actually really like the promotion up until that point. To be honest, I even like stuff into 95. Mm-hmm. Like the Flair Arn side of things in 95 is perfectly fine. Other stuff happening is fine. But anything involving Hogan after that moment is horrible until he turns. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, for sure. And it's tough because, yes, they were building something, but what were they building? Was it ever going to be legit competition with the direction they were going, or was it going to be a very high quality wrestling promotion like they were? I think Bischoff had aspirations to be bigger than that, and when you get Hogan handed to you on a platter, you have to at least take the hack at it, right? I mean, sure, it downturned the quality, and they probably alienated a lot of old school WCW fans, but in the moment, I can't blame him for saying fuck it, we're bringing Hogan in, and he's still a name, and we're going to see what we can do. But yeah, I mean, it's just, it's such an interesting year, and probably my favorite stuff in the whole year is Boss and Vader. Like, every match they had is just so much fun, and it's really just like Vader just reminding everyone what a badass he is. And Boss, you know, Big Boss Man was a great character and wrestler, but this was a whole new side of him. Like, seeing him go out there and just beat the shit out of Vader and getting hammered and, you know, beaten on over and over, just these stiff matches. This was kind of a different way to look at him too. But yeah, it's definitely a sneaky video.
You got the Funker around as well, isn't he?
Yeah, he's part of the stud stable almost a whole year, and he's a ton of fun as well. And Arn turning on Dustin is great at Bash of the Beach. And yeah, there's just so much good stuff in there. It really is just a good year.
I mean, not to put a dampening on it, but it makes me so angry how Flair is treated at the end of that.
Yeah.
You know, where the Butcher comes. Like, it's his retirement. It's Ric Flair. You know, for all we know, he's not coming back. But like the way that they just immediately segue into the next thing for Hogan, right, it just makes me sick. Like, even now, it makes me angry thinking about it. So,
and it should have been a red flag that Flair's not really going away permanently, because they definitely wouldn't have treated him like that if he was. It was like a dead giveaway. He's really just taking a break.
Well, do you know any rumors there were in 94 for people like Kurt Hennig to do the jump over to WCW?
Yes,
yeah. You know what I mean? Would you have been happier if, you know, they parlayed from Flair to Hogan versus Perfect, Parv?
What, in WCW?
Yeah, instead of having Butcher,
you have Hennig.
No, I never bought Mr. Perfect as a Hogan opponent because he was never booked strong enough. Like, he was never, you don't buy him as a threat. Not that anybody saw the Butcher as a threat to Hogan, but
probably would have been better than that, at least.
Anything would have been better than Butcher. But I don't know, like, the thing is that Hogan in this period now, it's not even Hogan anymore. He's literally Superman. Like, right, it's ridiculous. Like, when they do that 6-on-2 cage thing, and
it was like 12
like Savage
on
and Hogan, was it 12-on-2?
It's ridiculous. Yeah.
They go through the entire heel, like every top heel, including like Zeus and bloody, what's this, Atomic Bomb or whatever. Ultimate Solution. It's like they booked him. It's ridiculous, Hogan at that time. So it's almost like, who can you book against him? So yeah, why not? At least Hennig would have taken the bumps better.
Too bad they couldn't pull a Black Scorpion and have Flair be the guy in the mask helping Flair. it would have been some Black Scorpion level magic right there if it was revealed to be Flair after he loses in the cage, and then he comes out in the mask and it's him again. And I would argue, you know, I'm a fan of WWF that grew up, like, 94 is like my wheelhouse, right? I mean, I was just like all in 94. But looking back, I mean, I think WCW was lapping them in 94. You know what I mean? Just like from week to week. And yeah, I mean, that's how highly I'd put that year. But all right. Yeah. We spent a lot of time there, Alan. Why don't you head to your number six?
Okay, my number six is when Vader destroys Cactus Jack on WCW Saturday Night. They have the match in 93. They're in a bit of feud around the time. So they have this match on Saturday night, which you think, wow, this is a huge match in 93, you know, to be putting on TV, which WCW did a lot more of than WWF. And it, arguably they burned through the matches quicker because of it, or they could get feuds working along a lot, you know, a lot better if they kind of do something here and then they have the payoff, you know, on a pay-per-view down the line. But the whole thing was brutal. The powerbomb on the cement floor, Harley Race being involved laughing, and, you know, Vader, who's the man, who's the man? I just thought it was awesome. And it's just such a... Getting Cactus Jack as a sympathetic babyface from someone that, you know, the year before was... He was knocking around with a barbarian and, you know, he was a wild man for years before that. And I think, you know, there's a few interesting points I want to make here, just above and beyond this. So we had... You know, Vader, you know, he was the mean bully guy. So you never think that you get Vader to be a sympathetic heel himself. But somehow that happened in, you know, WWF in 98. You had Vader call himself a fat shit and he can't win any matches anymore when he lost at a random, I think it was an In Your House event. And there's an interesting kind of parallel, sort of parallels now. If you've been watching modern WWE, Parv, and then especially SummerSlam, they're positioning Brock now more of a sympathetic character where Braun Strowman's the bigger, stronger guy. And I think it's always interesting, kind of, we saw Cactus Jack was kind of this guy, and then he was, you know, sympathetic. Vader then, that happened to Vader, then that happened to someone like Brock Lesnar. And you can always get a monster heel. And if you play your cards right and book him well, you can actually make him a sympathetic character down the line when there's a bigger and better monster that comes along. But yeah, this whole feud was awesome, apart from which me and JT have touched on, which is the whole Lost in Cleveland skits where you had them, you know, running around looking for Cactus Jack, who was a sailor, and he was snapped out of it by Dustin Rhodes. You know, just randomly, you know, that was all a bit of a mess. But, you know, this actual program and how brutal it was, it was real hard for hardcore fans. This was kind of the big thing in 93. And, you know, it was really memorable for me. I mean, I would have been 11, 12 year old at the time. It was really graphic. And, you know, take bumps like that, you know, for the payoffs that, you know, Jack was getting was pretty crazy, really, looking back.
And who was the announcer? Doesn't Foley say something in his book that the announcer after that bump, like, made a joke about it, and they cut away, and he was, like, really pissed. Like, at the time, like, that he basically almost died, and the joking about it. Was it Jesse? Was it Larry? Like, who, do you remember that anecdote from his book?
I remember the anecdote, but...
He never says who it was. He just says, like, the announcer at the time kind of, like, joked about it, and it sounded like it was Bobby, the way he said it, like, joking, but Bobby wasn't there yet. So I didn't... No. I don't know. I mean, I thought he liked Jesse, so I didn't think it was him. So I kind of thought maybe it was, like, Larry or something.
That's the concrete, Tony! Race has removed the mat.
If he powerbombs him here, gently, he'll kill him. Whoa, whoa, no!
Oh! He powerbombed him on the cement, Tony.
He's not moving. He's not going to get up. He can count all day. Powerbombed him on the cement. You see, his eyes are open. This match is over.
We got a major problem here, Tony.
We really do. We have to go to a break. The referee over Cactus Jack Vance will be back.
For crying out loud, there's no need to do anything like this at all. Vader and Race have gone from the ring. The attendants are here from Metro Ambulance Service.
Maybe it was Larry doing commentary in 90.
I don't remember. I think I've seen the clip, but I can't recall who was announcing.
Did that happen on the pay-per-view, though?
It was on Saturday night.
It was on Saturday night, yeah.
Yeah, so it was interesting that it was on Saturday night as well.
Yeah.
One of the questions I have about this, because I have vivid memories of Harley Race getting presents every week. When did that happen? When was Cactus Jack sending Harley Race presents?
Well, they did a thing where Cactus was a present for against Sting. Remember, wasn't Harley revealing the presents? Is that what you're thinking?
That was a few years. That was in '91, yeah. Wasn't it?
Was that I remember there was a lot of weird skits like out in the desert where Harley Race kept on receiving cactuses week per week.
And, yeah, that was. I think that was around here. You're right, and because is that where Yoshi Kwan has the bag, the magical bag, or whatever that whole thing?
That's right. It was like weeks. I mean, I'm talking like maybe even months. A bit like where Harley Race was receiving like mysterious packages, and every once in a while we'd see like Cactus in the desert or whatever. It's a very odd period of television there. It all has good payoff, but I just can't, like, in my mind, I can't piece together the parts of that storyline. Like, I can't, do you know what I mean? Like, I haven't gone back and watched that stuff, so...
It was the missing in Cleveland stuff. Then he came back, and it all kind of the Cactus Jack was then the, you know, sending these cactuses and the Yoshi Kwan stuff. So I think it was, he got brutalized with Vader. He had the feud, he got brutalized, and then, you know, later on it went into a bit more weird stuff. But this, you never seen anything like this in WWF. Someone getting powerbombed and actually legitimately hurt, you know, for the sake of an angle. You know, it was crazy.
So I was checking out the clip really quick, and it is Tony and Jesse, but they're treating it very seriously, and they stay on it for a while. Like, they're on him getting the stretcher, and Jesse's being very serious. So it's not that. I don't know what it was. I have to go back.
It may have been on a syndicate, on one of the syndicates.
Yeah, maybe they're showing the clip or something.
Yeah, yeah, maybe it was that. I think that's more likely, to be honest. So that was my number six.
Yeah, so that, I mean, we're about halfway through the list now, guys, so we're going pretty long here. So what I'd like to do, Parv, if you're open to it, is why don't we come back in 2 weeks' time, and we'll finish up the rest of this. We'll make it episode 21, so you can help us break the record, not just tie it, and then we'll finish our list, because I don't want to shortchange us. We still each have, you know, five more things to talk about, and this has been a ton of fun. You open to coming back?
Yeah, and it's a neat parallel to when you came in and guested, you know, when you came on the main show, and then you stayed for a two week stint. Do you remember that?
That's right. Yeah, you come into the territory, help pop the town a little bit, and then you head back out.
Yeah, so it'll work nicely. So yeah, I think that's a good idea, guys. So we're gonna have both JT, myself, and the esteemed Parv on episode 21. So we're not gonna be no more questions again. So you can still send questions in. We can get the plunder bucket, as we call it, Parv. We don't call it what you know. I'm quite shocking. What did we used to call our mailbag, Parv? Oh, the sack. Yes. Oh, come on, Alan. I know it's the bulging sack. I know. I remember now. The brimming sack. The sack was brimming full, but we've got a plunder bucket full of questions. Okay. Yeah, full of questions. So if people want to send the questions in, they can do that. There's a few ways. You can email us at lettersfromcenterstage@gmail.com. You can tweet those to myself at Alan_cheapshot. You can message JT at @place2bnation. You can also send questions in when we post the shows on Place to Be Nation. There's a discuss feature at the bottom of there. You can register with create a discuss account, a Google account, a Facebook account. You can log in through them and ask them there. So plenty of ways you can ask questions. So the more the merrier. Lots of different questions. And like I said in the last episode, we may mix it up slightly moving forward, where we may do shorter questions. So instead of doing two or three questions a show, we may do little kind of quick questions where we answer good quick thoughts for 2 or 3 minutes, like, do we like a certain segment, a certain topic, things like that. So hit us up, guys. You can send the questions in that way. We'd really appreciate it.
For sure. And if you remember now, of course, we are fortnightly, so we'll be back here in 2 weeks' time with episode 21. In the meantime, check out all of our other shows. Subscribe to our feeds on iTunes, PlayStation Wrestling, PlayStation Pop, and Pro Wrestling Only. Social media, facebook.com/PlayStation, Twitter, @place2bnation, Instagram, and Tumblr. We're everywhere that we need to be. Join us in the comments section at PlayStation.com and shop with us, PlayStation.com/Amazon. All your online shopping help keep the site up and running. So, for the chap they call Alan, for my good buddy Parv, I'm JT. We're out. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time, continuing our top 10 things about WCW that we love. Take care.
Yo, baby! Yo, baby! Yo!
At the Mauler, completely maul his opponent, Steve Dahl.
What I've heard.
What's that shit? No softball game?
Light Magazine called it the Harvard of professional wrestling.
They're great.
Always go swimming with a buddy. Work real hard and always study.
The Honky Tonk Man is your winner.
One more time. Hey, there's the guy from Deliverance.
Ah! It's not hot.
You red-headed booger, you.
Is it spread?
Yes.
Now, if you can't find your scissors,
what? Wonderful. They call him Mr. Wonderful.
He knows it too.
Wonderful.
feeling.